When I was 21 years old, my father gave me a ladies' shop of my own to do exactly what I wanted to do with, and I enjoyed that very much. And we sold rather high-class clothing, and one of the companies that we stocked was named Jaeger. And they sold beautiful skirts and sweaters and dresses and coats. And it was just a lovely little antique shop. We had antique furniture, and it was just delightful. Well, one day when I was in the shop, the phone rang, and this very upper-class voice informed me that she was a Miss Simpson from Jaeger. Now, to appreciate the story fully, I have to describe to you the three London accents. These are not the three British, but London has three accents all of its own. There's the lower-class accent, which concentrates on not pronouncing as many consonants as they possibly can. So that instead of saying, would you like a piece of cake, they would say, here, mate, do you want a bit of cake? Then there's the middle-class accent, which is mine. And then we have the upper-class accent. And they tend to speak in the third-person singular all the time. Yes, in the third-person, not in the first-person, that's right. And they tend to exaggerate their vowels, so that instead of their saying, I'm pleased to see you, they would say, oh, one is simply delighted to chat with you. So this was this accent that came across the phone to me, was this last upper-class accent. Now, my sister-in-law, Maggie, had been in the habit of phoning me, and she would speak to me in various accents. And I had just learned to recognize when it was her. And it was her. So here came this upper-class accent, and I responded in kind. And she had said who she was, and I said, oh, one is just frightfully thrilled to hear your voice. And this voice said back to me, what a super day, isn't it? And the British always talk about the weather. That's the one thing we talk about after we've said hello. We can go on forever on the weather. And so I said, oh, yes, it's just absolutely spiffing. I said, one is just delighted to be alive on a day like this. One loves to see the little fluffy clouds scudding across the azure sky. And there was a sort of pause. And the voice said to me, well, now, I think we should get on with business. So I thought, oh, okay, now, if you want to stop now, we'll stop. So I changed my accent, and I came down to the lower-class accent. And I said, well, all right, love, if that's what you want to do, get on with it, because I ain't got all day to sit around here jawing with you. Then there was a slightly longer pause. And then this voice said to me, she referred to an order that I had placed for one of my customers, and she gave the number, and she gave the item that I had ordered, and suddenly the awful truth dawned on me that there was no way that Maggie could have known about that order. It really was Miss Simpson from Jaeger who I had been talking to. And I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to hang up or whether to explain what had happened. Then I felt I couldn't do that because I'd just been making fun of the way she was speaking. And anyway, she took it out of my hands and she continued the business, and I don't know what we said from there on. I was just hanging on waiting to get rid of this phone. Well, then, about 3 weeks later, the Jaeger representative who calls on all the little shops who sell his things just to see how we're doing came in. And I knew him very well. And he said to me, I've just had this very strange report from Miss Simpson. And I thought, oh, gosh. And he said, it seems you've had this rather funny phone call, and I explained to him what had happened, and he laughed, and he said, well, I am glad, because, he said, I've been sent to investigate you to see if you're a suitable person to handle our merchandise. I'm very careful how I answer the phone now.
I was told to put this thing on. Thank you, Marina. After that, I feel like I could sit down and we could all go home. In Revelations, in the third chapter, in the 20th verse, it says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hears my voice, I will come in to him. When I was 9 years old, I heard the voice of Jesus calling to me, and I opened up the door of my heart, and I invited him to come in. And if I were asked to take a piece of wire, you know how flimsy it is, very thin wire, and to shape it as my Christian life has progressed. I think you would find a lot of loops, a lot of climbs, and a lot of falls, and then a lot of plateaus. But God's not through with my life yet, nor is He through with yours. And I wonder, before I really get started with what I have to say, have you ever invited Jesus Christ to come into your heart? He wants to, and He's knocking, but we have to listen. I know that God's faithful. No matter how many times we've moved, you know, it's always hard to leave the last one. Because those friends are the best you've ever met in your whole life. You know how it goes. And then you go to a new place and you make new friends and you wonder, how could I think those friends were better than these friends? And then it's neat when you start to travel because you meet all these friends along the way. It also saves in motel bills sometimes. In 1970 and in 1971, my husband had a very strange assignment. He was chosen to be on the province program in Vietnam. But before we could go to this assignment, he had to learn to speak Vietnamese. If you've ever had that task, you know it might drive you to the psychiatrist or to the, you know, padded wall or one of those places. But bless his heart, he did learn to speak Vietnamese. And in June of 1971, our family sailed for the Philippines. You might wonder, what does this have to do with a family? But he was to spend 2 years in Vietnam, and we were to live at Clark Air Base in the Philippines. And from time to time, we were allowed to go to Vietnam on orders from the United States government. At that particular time, the government was trying to give a picture of what American families were like. Why they chose us, I don't know. But anyway, there we were. And he was the province advisor to the province chief in the Delta area of Vietnam, which is a lush, if you think it's beautiful and green out here, that over there is very lush and green with lots of water. Can you believe lots of water? And many flowers. The people are beautiful. I love the Vietnamese people. They are warm and they're wonderful, but I didn't come here to talk about the Vietnamese people. But nevertheless, he was in the city of Long Xuyen in the province of Anyang, and I won't ask you all to spell those weird little names. But I had a bodyguard assigned to me while I was over there, and of course he didn't speak any English, and I foolishly called him Killer. Because he had guns sticking out everywhere, you know. And there we were. But when I went over, they had a state dinner, I suppose, for me. And I met the man who was like the governor of a state. His title was the province chief. And he had about 1 million people under him. And he was their advisor on just every aspect of life, financial, agricultural, on it went. And his home was like something I've never seen in my life. He lived on a river. There was a huge boat dock that many ships came to. He had his own tennis court. My husband would love to have that right here. But he had his own tennis court and servants running out the ears. I bet the servants had servants for themselves. I've never seen so many in my life. It looked like an arsenal in places. You know these old Wild West movies you've seen where you look down the hall and there were guns stacked up? Well, there were those all over the place, and every place you looked, there were men guarding them. Because remember, this is in the middle of the war. We were in a B-52 raid one time, and my 17-year-old daughter jumped in my lap. It was the funniest thing. Poor child. I thought she wanted good padding if she were going to be hit, I suppose. Another time that we went over there, this same man, Colonel Pham Van Mon was his name, had a delightful wife, and they had 5 beautiful children. And Colonel Mon had this dinner party in our honor at a restaurant. Now, if the American Restaurant Society went there to inspect, I don't know what sort of a rating this place would get. But we were seated. You crossed a little bridge, and you sat there on the table, and we were seated there, and my daughter was sitting across from me, and she's about my best friend, I suppose. And we have, you know, a look. You can crack up. I crack up real easy, but anyway, a look will do it. We heard this splashing, and I looked around. I, you know, wanted to be the epitome of polite American folks. So anyway, I looked around, and there was this man taking a bath. Then I had heard tales about if you were an honored guest over there, what would happen? From drinking blood on to, you know, being cut and all, and I thought, what is this night going to produce? And I had heard one story that an honored guest, if they were presented a little bird to eat, that you ate head and all. And I thought, no, this would never happen to me. But you guessed it, a smiling waiter came out with a tray full. Little rice spears, about that long. And by this time, I'd become pretty good with chopsticks. So I thought, well, I'm going to do like everybody else, but I won't eat the head. No way. And I thought, well, we'll have an international incident because I'm not going to eat that little thing's head. And all around, you could hear bones crunching and stuff. And my daughter looked at me, and I looked at her, and I know she was thinking what I was thinking. But this young American captain was sitting next to me, and he says out of the corner of his mouth, if you'll turn your head, it'll be gone. And I turned my head, and it was gone. And later I told my husband, I said, if you have anything to do with this man's efficiency report, fella, you give him a great one. Because this man went over and above, because not only did he eat my bird, he ate my daughter's bird. And as the custom is over there, you never let your guest's plate go empty, ever. And I turned around, and bless my soul, another bird was there. So that poor man had his fill of birds that night. In March of 1972, my husband and Colonel Mon, who was our gracious host, were out on an operation together. They had been under heavy fire from the VC and the NVA. And in the wee small hours of the morning, my husband said to his good friend, Colonel Mon, he said, if you ever need a home, if your country should ever fall, heaven forbid, you let me know. And we will try to do something about it because my home is yours. Never did my husband realize, I think, what he was saying. Because we got orders to come home in June of 1973. And good old Uncle Sam sent us to the place we said we did not want to go, back to Washington, D.C. But back we went. My husband was assigned to the National War College there. And so while we were there, later on, he was assigned to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And 30th of April in 1975, as you well know, Vietnam fell. And this was a very dark day for us because we had many friends. My husband's house girl, whom I dearly adored, she about came to my belly button, but I just adored her. She had 10 children. What happened to her? You know, and on of these gracious, wonderful people that had been so kind to us and whom we had had the joy of knowing. And how I prayed, and I got my Christian friends to pray, and our whole church prayed for these people. They were Buddhist people who never, I'm sure, imagined that a Christian would be praying to them. A Christian can pray without praying to statues. You don't have to use josh sticks or incense sticks to pray. You can go directly to the living God through Jesus Christ, his only son. Well, we got word that many people were escaping from Vietnam, and we knew that a man in Colonel Mon's position would be on the death list, and indeed he was. By this time, he had left Anyang province, and he was the special assistant to the mayor in the city of Saigon. Well, my husband kept checking and checking as those lists would come into the Pentagon on who had escaped and who hadn't escaped. And there was no Pham Van Mon at all. And so I suppose in our hearts we expected the worst to happen. But God is gracious, and God does hear our prayers when we don't even realize he's answered our prayers. Because the day that Saigon fell, Colonel Mon and his family escaped. Now, I could tell you about this until probably midnight, but I'll just touch very briefly on that. He had five children, and his wife and his wife's brother, and they were fired upon when they tried to enter this naval base, but they finally got into it. All the ships were full, and they were just spilling over with humanity, and they couldn't get on one. And finally, he saw a man that he knew, and he said, "Try that one over there. I don't think the engines work, but try." So they got on it, and the engines didn't work. And there was no food, and there was no water. And I wouldn't call it a boat. My husband told me I must call this properly. It's a ship, an LSD. And it normally holds 600 people. But there were 2,500 people on this ship with no engine. Well, there was an engine, but it wouldn't work. So what would they do? Because there was just mass hysteria everywhere. And so all the people, all the ladies especially, drug out their jewels. And they all gave everything that they had to a little tugboat owner who was trying to escape down the river. And so he agreed to pull them out of the Saigon River. And down they went. And they were fired upon. And when the fire started, the tugboat cut the tow line. And there they were. But finally they got out to sea. And the men got in and frantically worked on this engine. And it did turn over enough to get them into the open sea. They had been out about a mile, I suppose, and the engine quit. And they were in the sea at this time. And if you've ever been at sea, you know, you're merciless. You're at the mercy of the sea. And finally, a U.S. destroyer happened by, and he towed this ship into Subic Bay in the Philippines. And they changed from there, and they went to Guam to be at a refugee camp. And while they were in Guam, Colonel Juan wrote us a letter. I wish I could share the whole thing with you, but one part of it that really sticks in my mind was, "I am asking, sir, your precious help." And as you know, they had to have help to get out of those camps. And in the meantime, we had just used every source we knew to try to find Colonel Mon, because at last we had found that he was out and they didn't know who he was. He was lost. But eventually, I won't go into all that, but eventually my husband traced him down, and they were sent to Indian Town Gap, Pennsylvania. Well, if you've ever lived in the tropics, you know it's not cold. And these people were freezing in early summer. We immediately went up there to see these people, and it nearly broke my heart, because there they were, what I had remembered before, in a beautiful estate, Mrs. Mon, bejeweled, the whole picture, you know, servants. She had a small baby, and never before had she even fooled with this baby at all, never even changed his diaper. She had a maid to do that. But here she was. She had no front teeth. In her escape, somehow she had lost her bridge. And there she was. She looked like a peasant lady that you would see. And they were behind this rope. We couldn't even get to them. And I just wanted to grab them out of there and run away with those people, but, you know, all the red tape. So we had to vouch that we would be their security and feed them and so on and so forth. So 2 weeks later, on the 20th of June in 1975, we borrowed a van from one of my friends, and we went up there to get these people out of this camp. I had really prayed that God would just use us to touch these people's lives, that they would see that Christians are different, that Christians have something that Buddhists don't have. And the way God worked was just beautiful. We got in this van, it looked like the clowns in a circus, and with all they had were in little plastic bags. And the clothes that they had were some clothes that had been given them by, you know, people who were gracious enough to do this. And so we stopped to get a Coca. That's what the children wanted, was a Coca. They were in America, you know, and that's the universal drink anyway. So we stopped at this place, and I was just really dreading putting all those nickels and dimes in a machine for nine people. So the young man there, without saying anything to us, said, "I tell you what, I'll open the machine and everybody can choose what they want." Now, you know that was from the Lord. No station attendant is going to do that on his own. Then we decided that their first meal should be McDonald's. Why not, you know, hamburger and Coke? So we stopped near our house at a McDonald's. And that was an ordeal, too. But wouldn't you know, in Washington, you rarely see somebody you know when you go anyplace. One of the deacons from our church came in with his family. The Lord sent those people that we could introduce our friends to them. Several days later, I introduced them to shopping in a grocery store, which was an experience and a half. Wouldn't you know, another one of my Christian friends came in. This was not just something to happen by chance. This was truly of the Lord's with these people. But let me back up. After McDonald's, we went home. Now, here we were with all these people in our house. Remind you, please, that it was June and we were burning up and they had sweaters on. They were freezing to death. And my husband and I have this thermostat thing all summer long. You know, I freeze and he burns up and we play this game all summer with the thermostat. But here they were freezing, so he didn't have much choice that time. But the first meal, real meal, that I was to prepare for them was something that I would never forget as long as I lived on this earth. They did not speak English. And how long can you smile? You know? Okay, my husband spoke Vietnamese, but he was busy chatting with Colonel Mon down in the den. And here we were. And heaven forbid that Madame, that's what they call me, that Madame should turn her little finger. I wish they could see me, you know, scrubbing floors and windows and all that. But anyway, they were going to cook. I had everything all planned out. It was my kitchen. You know the feeling? And here they were, all over. They took things from the refrigerator and they squatted in the oriental fashion all along my floor, chopping stuff up, you know, on the floor for dinner. And I thought, what am I going to do? And I... So they decided they wanted shrimp. And I had not planned shrimp. I was going to have chicken because everybody likes chicken, supposedly. So we finally got across. They wanted shrimp. I got a can of shrimp. That's not what they wanted. I went to the freezer. I had one box of breaded shrimp. Twit, who was the wife, got that, and she started washing the breading off the shrimp because something was wrong with it, and I thought I was going to scream. I really did. It was really getting to me about this time, and I went out on the patio, and I said, okay, Lord, you've got to do something. And it was just as if Jesus himself had been standing there, and he said, okay, Jane, it's all right. And there was this sense of peace that just came across to me. And I didn't care what they did with the shrimp after that. I really didn't care. I knew that if worse came to worse, I could get a jar of peanut butter and go off in a closet and eat it. But we had to get down to the nitty-gritties of really living with these people, which was quite an experience. The children had to get in school. Mind you, it was the end of June, and school starts in D.C. usually in late August, and I had to get these children prepared to go to public schools. So we went through all that hoop-de-doo, and I got them finally in a special summer school that majored in speaking and in training people who speak foreign languages to speak English. And after I took them to school every morning, they would come home and we'd have our lunch. And then I've taught school for 9 years, so I thought I could teach them a little something. So I would tutor them in English every afternoon for all summer. And might I add, one has graduated from high school and is in college now, and they're doing all right. But the Lord very graciously prepared a place for these people to live because he knew that I couldn't take that too long. But a minister in our church, who was a retired man, he and his wife were called out of town for a long period of time. And so these people moved into their home. We rented it for them, and it was furnished. God was faithful, and he had gotten these people out of Vietnam. But finally, a new person was to enter the picture, and her name was Son. She was the cousin. You know, everybody's kin to everybody else over there. She was the cousin to Colonel Mon, and she was in New York. Well, her husband did not come out, and we do not know about him to this day. We have heard there's still an underground, and by the way, if you're interested, they're still fighting in the Delta. But her husband was still there, and she had owned a restaurant in Nha Trang. which was the largest hotel restaurant there, and many of our American friends in the State Department had known her before, and she decided that she and Colonel Mond should open up a restaurant in Washington, D.C. Well, we had tried unsuccessfully to get Colonel Mond a job. We had tried everything. My husband had spent days and days on the phone. You know, hey, do you know somebody who would? And on it went. And finally, we didn't know what else to do with these people. They had a little money, not much. I started to bring it this morning, and I decided I wouldn't. But I have a stack of Vietnamese money about that tall that Colonel Mond brought out. It's about $250,000, I suppose. It's not worth a penny. But they had a little bit of American money that they had, and we got together $10,000 of our money from various sources to help them get a restaurant. We hunted, and that's another story, too. But on the very last day that we had given ourselves to find a restaurant, we found one. We bought it, and we started. We had now 13 dependents. Because she has children and her brother was also with them. At Thanksgiving time, my son said, "Good grief, you need a passport to get to the table." But we finally got the restaurant, and my husband, we worked. It was an old thing. I cried when I walked in the door. I couldn't believe this was happening to me. But anyway, on the 10th of February, we opened the restaurant. After my husband leaving for work before 6 in the morning, going to the Pentagon, working all day, coming to the restaurant, straight from work, putting on overalls, and he'd work till midnight, and this went on for months. But we opened the restaurant, didn't have too much business. It was in an excellent location, a block south of the Hilton Hotel. But I guess they kept it all. But Colonel Mond was really going through a culture shock about this time. Everybody else was busy working, and you'd go down there, and he was still taking his siesta in the afternoon. You know, how much of that can you take? But we needed more money for operation expenses. So we borrowed the money that we had saved for our son's college. And as time went on, we needed more money for operations. And my husband borrowed on every insurance policy that he had. And we thought, well, what are we going to do? Well, during my quiet time every day, I pray through the Psalms. I always take a psalm a day because I love David, and I use the Living Bible for that. And those words are so real. They're so today. They just really express your innermost feelings. And the Psalms were just too precious for words. During this time, I was reading a book by Philip Keller called A Shepherd Looks at Psalm 23. I'm sure some of you have read it. Do you remember the part in it where a shepherd sometimes has a pet sheep and he has a staff that he pulls that little sheep close to him? Well, at times I was feeling like I were that little sheep and that God was pulling me very close to his side. And I was just very special to him. But the Psalms really were speaking to me during all this time. And I'll never forget the day, in 75, about September, I suppose, my husband came in, and I have never seen him like this in my life, and I hope I never do again. And he told me, "Well, Jane, we can't make it in this restaurant, and we're going to lose everything we've got." Well, I said, "That's just what you think. We're not, because God will not let that happen." I was told by many people around me, "You're crazy. God's not going to save you just because you went into something like this for these people. After all, they're Buddhist and you're Christian. Why should he?" But that's not right. And I just hung in there because God's not going to bring you somewhere and then drop you. He's not a sadist, for goodness sake. But I went through my Bible as I was thinking about sharing this with you today. And it's really marked up. I should have brought it. You can see the teardrops on some of the pages and so on. But these are quotes from God's Word and how they just jump up off the pages to me. They're true if you're going through a financial problem like I was or any other kind. Just let me share some of these. Chapter 8, verse 12. He, speaking of God, does not ignore the prayer of men in trouble when they call to him for help. 25, verse 3, none who have faith in God will ever be disgraced for trusting him. 35:27, Great is the Lord who, listen to this, enjoys helping his children. 37, verse 40. Now listen to this, it's a goodie. Because they trust in him, he helps them and delivers them. Chapter 50, verse 15. This is God speaking. He says, I want you to trust me in your time of trouble so I can rescue you and you can give me the glory. Psalm 147, verse 11. His joy, this is God's very joy, is in those who reverence him, those who expect him to be loving and kind. Well, was I expecting him to be loving or kind, or pull the rug right out from under me? And I had to believe I was expecting God to be loving and kind. I told you before that Son's husband had not gotten out of Vietnam, but we found out that her sister-in-law had, and she knew that I had been praying that her sister-in-law would get out. And finally one day, Son came to me. She's a feisty little lady. Those Oriental business ladies are something else. And she said, you're different. And I said, well, weird, yes. She said, no, you're different. Her English, by the way, she was the only one that could speak impeccable English. She said, you're different, and I want you to know that if my husband ever gets out of Vietnam, I will believe in your God. And I thought, well, how about that? They had come to our church strictly out of politeness. They had heard my pastor say, to become a Christian, all you have to do is to believe that Jesus Christ is God's only Son, that he is alive, he's living. All you have to do, and it's so simple. People get hung up on it because it's so simple. Are you getting hung up on it because it's so simple? They want to do something. But before all this had happened, way back before the Mons ever came to our house, I had told God something when I was praying to him, and I said, please, Lord, stretch my faith. He was doing it. I didn't know how elastic it was. But during all of this, words from Psalms, God was my rock. He was my shield. He was my high place that I could hide and no one could touch me. He was my hiding place. And finally, we sold the restaurant after two times we thought we had, but not until January of 1977. There were times where I did not know how we could pay our personal bills, much less the restaurant's. But never once did God let us fail. Money came from very strange sources. It was just too beautiful to believe. God is faithful, and God indeed is in control. If you're interested, Son is still in the restaurant. She's doing well. Colonel Mon decided he wanted out. He wanted no part of this. At this time, he is a waiter. My husband had appointments for this man to get him some jobs, and he would not even go for an interview. I suppose this is a man who has totally given up. But during this time, I had not fallen. God had held my hand securely. I might have stumbled down a little bit, but he still had hold of my hand, and he would not let go. And Psalms 120, verse 1 says, in my troubles, I pled with God to help me, and he did. There are many more cases that I could bring to you from the Psalms, but I would challenge you to accept Jesus as your Savior, to experience a new relationship with him, to read your Bible, and to know the promises, because you can't claim them unless you know them. And I would just leave with you today that God is faithful, and he will never desert or make his children ashamed.